Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now is Jill Abramson. She was Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times, then Managing Editor, then the Executive Editor, the top job in the Times newsroom. She was the first woman in each of those positions as she rose through the ranks. Now, with 5 years' distance from the Times and teaching at Harvard, Jill Abramson has written a book about some of the profound changes affecting journalism and, by extension, American democracy as a result of digital technology changing basically everything about how news organizations can pay for what they do. The book profiles two old media organizations, the Times and Washington Post, and two upstart digital native ones, BuzzFeed and Vice News, both of which have moved into hard news after starting out as other things. But the big ideas in the book have been overshadowed so far by questions about possible instances of plagiarism on its pages and criticism by some younger journalists that Abramson is dismissive of what they do, even while making factual errors about them. So we will try now to do both things. Talk to Jill Abramson about the backlash and questions about her integrity that are being raised, but also about the research she's done and her perspective with her unique set of experiences on the state of journalism, which is so vital to us all in ways that many people took for granted before Donald Trump, you might say. The book is called Merchants of Truth: The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. I will note that for a work that's generating plagiarism questions, I don't know if I've ever before seen a book that ends with 69 pages of footnotes citing specific sources for more than 1,000 things in the book. So I will say this does not look like those scandals in which reporters just make stuff up or don't really do original work. So Jill Abramson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And let's deal with some of the controversies first. We have expected you to cancel this interview, which was scheduled before the controversies broke out and you started getting some very critical press. But I see you're doing this and other scheduled appearances. Why put yourself in these positions right at this time?
Because I think this book is so important. And I devoted, 3 years plus of my time to making it deep and a satisfying read, and I agree with you that it sheds light on the health and fabric of our democracy right now, and I think that it's a great book and I'm proud of it, so I keep on keeping on.
It's a good blurb for the next edition's back cover. It's a great book, Jill Abramson, former New York Times. What would you say in your own words now about what mistakes you made that have rightfully drawn scrutiny and criticism, and what might you think critics or the media covering these things have blown up beyond what's there?
Oh, well, I'm not going to play victim or say things have been blown up. I'm happy to explain what happened to you and your audience. What happened here is that, and it's limited to the chapters on Vice, where I think some of the employees did interpret what I wrote as somehow old media snobism, maybe. I certainly did not mean it that way. I found both Vice and BuzzFeed to be the most interesting places to do my reporting. Primarily it was six passages that one of their employees went on Twitter to claim that the wording was so close that, he called it plagiarism. In almost all of the cases cited on Twitter, I had credited these very sources, but for other pages of the book. And, what I have to plead guilty to is being very sloppy in the end game of the book, which included doing something — I won't bore you with getting into the weeds, but I was doing something that I'd never done before called trailing phrase footnotes, which were supposed to begin with a phrase and then credit. And I didn't catch all of them. And it was sloppy. You know, I remember being rushed going through and checking them all. And, you know, I'm not making any excuses, but sometimes it's hard, you know, if the text doesn't keep saying according to, let's say, a publication called Relapse is one where I didn't cite every quote, but I cited, you know, two things to them. You know, I should have cited them all, but you can't in a narrative book keep saying according to blah, 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 blah. It's not quite the same writing style as journalism, where I would keep citing the same source and indeed wish I had just done in these cases, because it would have, you know, not — it would have cost me nothing. And obviously, I'm so sorry to any of these writers who feel I stole their work. I would just never do that. And I do think the fact that all but two are credited elsewhere show I had no intention not to cite or credit their work, and that this was true sloppiness, which I find, you know, terrible and very serious. I'm not saying it's not serious.
At a time when there's so much distrust of the so-called mainstream media, what do you think this could have in terms of an effect on people who think, well, gee, the Times or the Washington Post or anyone in their zeal to get stories out maybe are sloppy in this way a lot of more time than we realize? And so, well, what should I think about what I read at any of these places?
I guess, you know, I have always felt that the key to dealing with such problems, which have bedeviled journalism for all of my lifetime, is to be transparent about mistakes and correct them immediately or as soon as possible. And that's what I've endeavored to do here. And, you know, the New York Times does run corrections every day. I actually think that enhances the credibility of the Times' news report and doesn't detract from it. I'm not saying that correcting everything and being transparent in my book should necessarily result in the same effect. But
and it wasn't just failure to attribute. It was also some mistakes that made some of the younger journalists feel dissed. Like one said that you were wrong on whether they were trans and whether they had an environmental science background, wrapped in a tone that raised questions about whether you respect people whose career paths were different than yours, as an article in Vox put it.
Right. The transgender misidentification was something that appeared in the uncorrected galleys, and a mistake I actually caught myself and corrected before the book was printed. The tone, you know, I had to focus on the fact that, you know, Vice News Tonight on HBO has, you know, it's geared to trying to make nightly news appealing to a younger audience who mostly stream it rather than watch it as appointment TV. And I probably made too much of how all of these correspondents looked. And, you know, I can see now that that seemed to be trivializing their work. I don't feel I do that in the book. I go into great detail about some of the great pieces that these journalists have done, including Ellie Reeve, who did fantastic work on Charlottesville. So I meant no belittling. I have taken that paragraph that focuses on them having sort of what I call the look. Not because it's inaccurate, but because I realized that it was taken as some kind of diss, which I didn't mean.
My guest is Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times, now the author of Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. And turning to what you were trying to communicate in your book, one of the terms in it that people might not know, is native advertising. Mm-hmm. What is that and how central is it to your story?
Well, I'll say what it is first, but I feel I should disclose that I hold a dim view of it, because it's advertising that very closely mimics the content of either the publication or the news show that it's advertising on. And sometimes the fact that it's advertising isn't disclosed prominently enough, in my opinion. And to quickly give an example, you know, BuzzFeed in its early days and even now is known for those photo chains of adorable puppies and kittens. And they were doing native advertising for Purina's Friskies, cat and kitten food. And so, you know, they did branded native advertising, an ad that's called Dear Kitten. That's actually very amusing and millions of people have clicked on it. But, you know, it seems while you're watching so much of it till the end where you see the Friskies logo, that it's just like clever storytelling, like anything else in BuzzFeed.
And so you're right about the Times, that today it's doing this like Facebook does. An industry newsletter described it as packaging up readers' emotions as a data point for sales and ad auctioning systems. You write, what does that even mean?
Well, what it means is that, you know, Facebook has made a high art of studying exactly what emotional and other reactions all of its users have to any piece of content that they click on or share. And, you know, what a number of people have discovered, which Facebook has known for a long time, is people are often moved to share emotional content, either things that like bring a smile to their face or snap them out of boredom or make them angry. And, you know, there's a science called psychographics, which studies this and is available to anyone who wants to pay the myriad firms that do it.
The Times rejected the idea that it's doing what Facebook does because any reader information the Times is packaging is aggregated and anonymous. I guess that means Facebook sells data that is really about you as an individual, and the Times says it doesn't. Meaningful distinction?
It is a meaningful distinction because Facebook also, as we know, promised to, you know, safeguard its users' privacy and confidentiality. And, you know, was kind of a scandal a few months ago when it came out and the New York Times did fabulous reporting on this, that they were sharing specific names of users and information to advertisers. And the Times is saying, like, we don't do that. So it's meaningful, but, you know, it's still, you know, data is everything right now, as you well know, Brian. And, you know, it's making data that, you know, the Times or anyone can collect available to advertisers. It's another lore proper safeguards in their case.
And how does all that relate to your choice of BuzzFeed and Vice as the two news organizations to profile side by side with the Times and Washington
Right.
Post?
Well, they were at the forefront of native and branded advertising. In some ways, you know, in their early days, they were more advertising agencies than content creators. And Vice had, you know, a big branded advertising shop that they called very cleverly Virtue, Vice and Virtue. And, you know, Virtue was, because Vice has a had a very defined audience, mostly young male. So it was a natural place for beer companies or streetwear company, you know, designers to place ads. And because normal advertising has stopped being as effective as it once was, and this storytelling mimicking, you know, journalism really, native advertising has found to be, you know, much more interesting and effective to an audience. And so, you know, they were signing clients right and left and got, you know, more recently Bank of America to sponsor a personal finance show geared to younger people on how to manage their money. And, you know, that close kind of sponsorship of content that is news was something when I was growing up in journalism wasn't done. And BuzzFeed, like very early on, you know, was doing only branded advertising. They were not, you know, accepting those little click ads that litter many of our feeds now. So they were the pioneers, and everyone else in journalism kind of jumped in because they saw how much money, you know, BuzzFeed and Vice were raking it in, and they were able to grow while everyone else was making cuts.
We have to take a break in a minute, and then we'll talk about some other things, like how you started researching this book before Donald Trump was elected president, and then his election may have changed the business environment for The Times and The Washington Post dramatically. We'll also get into some Jeff Bezos stuff as Washington Post owner, and we can take some phone calls for Jill Abramson, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anyone in journalism or anyone not, 212-433-9692. But just to what you were saying, BuzzFeed just eliminated its national desk, its entire national desk, after it was doing impact reporting on the Trump investigations and things like that.
And sexual abuse strong on.
Because of its own financial problems, that's gone. So what's the lesson in that?
The lesson in that is the lesson that the Washington Post and the New York Times have known all along, that doing quality news that requires enterprise reporting and teams of reporters is very expensive. And it's sort of been a loss leader for BuzzFeed, which as long as it was making money hand over fist in other areas like the listicles and the quizzes and whatnot, they were happy to, you know, class up their brand with great journalism. They were a Pulitzer finalist last year. But, you know, it's expensive to support a 20 journalist investigative unit.
We'll continue in a minute. Stay with us. WNYC with former New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson, whose new book is Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. Our phone number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You started this book before Trump was elected president. As I said before the break, how much has his election transformed the stories you tell here of the Times and Washington Post in particular?
It's been a big factor. I think a former colleague of mine at the Times, Jeff Gerth, said it perfectly. He called them Trump and the Times sparring partners with benefits. And the benefits have been, you know, the so-called Trump bump, which has brought, you know, millions of new digital subscribers to the Times. It now has more than 4 million. It had, I think, just about 2 million right before President Trump's election. So, you know, it has been, you know, a real, it meaning Trump's presidency, A, has made people more hungry for news, sometimes more hungry for news that is consistent with their own ideological point of view about him. But, you know, hungry for news. The cable news shows have all seen their audiences boom, you know, donations to ProPublica, which I am on an advisory board of, boomed. And the Washington Post has gotten a lot of new subscribers and pronounced itself profitable, even though it's privately owned. So, you know, he's been a boon. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, you can look at what the most read stories are any day in the Times. And yesterday's, you know, was a near 3,000-word, you know, investigative piece about him, which is great. You know, sometimes, you know, when I'm scrolling through their apps, you know, I've sort of thumbed through two full screens before I get to anything that isn't Trump, because every Trump story gets tons of clicks. Hmm. He's a form of clickbait. And, you know, that too is you know, it's an implicit financial benefit.
Asher in Croton-on-Hudson. You're on WNYC with Jill Abramson. Hello.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. So yesterday, the Times reported that Clarence Thomas feels that Sullivan case should be reconsidered.
And wait. Remind us of the Sullivan case.
You want me to?
You? Yes.
It is the most historic and important libel decision, which made the bar for public officials and public people like celebrities to say they were libeled extremely high.
In other words, they can't sue a news organization easily for critical things the news organizations
right,
about
because
them.
They are considered public people.
And for context, Asher is bringing up what Clarence Thomas had to say about this. You wrote a book with Jane Mayer on Clarence Thomas, and you've called for his impeachment, haven't you?
I have asked should he be impeached,
okay,
because I believe there's considerable evidence that he perjured himself to win confirmation, and wrote about that, you know, a year or so ago for New York Magazine. But here, what Justice Thomas, and I'm relieved that he stands alone at this point, what he is writing harmonizes with President Trump, who, you know, threatened in his many threats aimed at the news media to, quote unquote, open up the libel laws, meaning he was going to be able to sue all of these people doing what he terms fake news. So, you know, it's kind of a frightening echo of that, and very distressing if that idea caught on beyond Justice Thomas.
Asher, thank you for raising it. Wendy in Westfield, you're on WNYC with Jill Abramson. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm listening to this story through the lens of being a book editor and a magazine editor, and I'm curious about your feeling about where were the fact checkers at the publisher. I feel like there's a piece of this that's about that getting really sloppy at magazines and blogs and book publishers, and I'm just curious what you'd say to that aspect, because it's not just up to the author. You need professional people helping an author to do
right.
It correctly.
There have been a couple of interesting pieces about that in the wake, almost immediately after some of the Vice reporters pointed out what they saw as errors. And, you know, publishing has changed since back, you know, back in the day when Jane Mayer and I wrote Strange Justice, you know, the publisher helped supply fact-checking. citations, footnotes, indexing, copy editing, certainly. And now
they don't feel they can afford to do that anymore.
I think that that's right. It's shifted to the author. I'm not at all like saying Simon & Schuster is to blame here, because I did retain, you know, people to do all of that. But at the end of the day, like, even though these trailing footnotes like bedeviled me and I never really got the hang of them, it's on me. It just is.
Hannah in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Jill. So nice to speak to you. I am a working journalist, and Jill has been a hero of mine from the beginning of my career. And I was so disappointed in this book. I have such a hard time making the case that the work that I do is different or harder than aggregation or, you know, a lot of this fake news sloppiness online. And when someone, you know, in such a high position in the journalism industry doesn't record her interviews and makes these kind of errors, and the plagiarism in the book, it would just broke my heart. And I was wondering how we're supposed to move forward if this is our example. Thank you.
Well, you know, what I want to say first is I'm so sorry that I've disappointed you, and I will do everything I can to win your trust back and the trust of readers by correcting my mistakes, putting quotes and citations where they should have been in the first place. And all I can say is, and you know, I'm not happy to say it, that this was not intentional taking of someone else's work. And you know, I work very hard to be a scrupulous reporter. I don't think whether I taped interviews or not necessarily speaks to that. But, you know, I realize I have disappointed some people. I'm very sorry about that.
Hannah, thank you. On that not taping, you've said you don't record your interviews, as many journalists do these days, whether they're in broadcast or not. Because you have an almost photographic memory?
Yeah, that isn't only why. I can take notes very quickly. And what I meant by that is afterwards I can visualize on the page what the most critical quotes were. And, you know, I often do check back with sources that the quote is accurate in, you know, news reporting. But, you know, when I was starting out, I was told that a big clunky tape recorder, which of course now is just your cell phone, somehow made people nervous and less candid, and that it was a barrier rather than a help. I have in the past used taped interviews in, you know, my first book. So it's not like I've never done it, but I wasn't bragging. I don't want anyone to think I was bragging about not taping and saying I don't ever need to tape because I remember every word anybody said. But I do have an almost photographic memory for my own notes.
A critique in the Vox article by one of their sources says, in effect, you are both a trailblazer for women, someone whose troubles right now are drawing more Schadenfreude than if a man was having them, but also someone who is blinded by being a relatively privileged woman within the patriarchal system of journalism that you therefore helped to perpetuate. I'm paraphrasing. But how do you hear a description like that?
You know, it's painful, and I don't think that description is true either. I really don't think. How do I reflect the patriarchy? I don't really get that. And I'm not gonna, you know, cry gender in terms of who's criticized me. I mean, we just heard from your previous caller, who's a woman, who, you know, says very forthrightly what she thinks, so.
We're just about out of time. Let me touch two other things real quick. One, you're getting a lot of attention from conservative media for writing that the tone of the Times and Washington Post regarding Trump is more adversarial, in part to attract and service a growing anti-Trump readership. That makes it sound like they're pandering and losing sight of unbiased reporting for money and clicks. But just before that in the book, I saw you call the coverage of Trump deservedly tough. So how do you square those two statements?
I guess how I square them as I see some headlines that are over the top and feel like they have loaded words in them to me. Certain, you know, paragraphs of analytic pieces that seem to veer into, you know, opinion writing more than distanced thinking. I see it mostly really, you know, when reporters go on cable TV shows or on panels wedged between partisans or former prosecutors, and it's hard to keep who's saying what straight, and on Twitter.
Of course, there's a false equivalency problem potentially, right? That by trying so hard to give various sides equal weight.
No, I don't. Yeah.
News organizations can give a false impression of equivalency when, in this case, Trump is doing things that are objectively, observably, so much more extreme than
Absolutely.
Any president you've covered in your lifetime or me.
Yeah. I do think the coverage is deserved. I just think on some days it isn't calibrated in such a way. Let's say, why are there five different Trump stories? I mean, at the Wall Street Journal, when I worked there, you know, editors became adept at sort of combining different things. And, you know, I think just because those stories get so many clicks, there's a bit of an incentive to have so many.
And last thing, just give me a quick Jeff Bezos thought. The richest man in the world and currently a villain here in New York,
right. But
at the same time kind of a savior of the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
having bought it from the Graham family when its profitability was really in doubt. And he's taken more attacks from President Trump for it than maybe anyone else in Trump's hated news media.
I think the Times is up there with him.
Yeah, but as an individual. But he ran away from a fight with people like State Senator Michael Janaris and City Councilman Jimmy Van Bramer.
That's totally true.
Or maybe AOC. But after reporting this book, do you get why he's willing to withstand Trump's withering tongue week in and week out, but wouldn't hang around to negotiate some community benefits in Long Island City?
Well, you know, in the case of where to locate his facilities, he had no shortage of suitors. And I think this is a moment where I haven't done reporting on this, mm-hmm. so I shouldn't even conjecture. But, you know, he's been in the news a lot lately. You know, he wrote in Medium about his relationship and a new relationship and photos and whatnot. And maybe he just felt like, I don't need another fight on my hands right now. He's been an excellent steward of the Washington Post. And, you know, he's given them new resources to come back to the quality, really, of the Bradley era. And we should all be grateful to him for saving an important American institution, truly.
The book is called Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts, by former New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.